Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to Spin the Rally Pod. Another week in lockdown, another week without the rev of a real live rally car. So another chance for Dirtfish Rally's David Evans and Colin Clark, former team boss George Donaldson, and me, rally fan Lisa O'Sullivan, to shine the light on another rally star. But first, David, George, we need to address some really rather alarming images we've seen on social media recently, namely Colin Clark getting his hair cut.
Hang on, I'm actually behind this. I've got to say, I haven't seen this. So
okay, you don't want to. It's like a sort of snuff movie, but nobody gets killed. It's awful.
Where did you go?
Patricide. It's patricide.
He went to the farm.
Farm.
Yeah, but listen,
was it like sheep shearing or something?
Well,
the strange thing is, I'd been into Boots earlier that day to get some medicine for the kids.
And I had
looked at the hair, the proper professional hair trimmers. And they
you
were
don't
about
get
20,
them in Boots. They're cheap.
Well, they're
nasty.
About 20, 25 quid, 30 quid. And I thought, that's 25, 30 quid I don't have to spend. I've got a beard trimmer.
Oh, dear. The story gets worse.
So have you done it yourself?
But no, the kids did it. The kids did it, David. You've got to look. It actually, from what looked like an absolute disaster and was really, you know, an almost break the lockdown type, you know, status to run to the hairdresser's house. From that, I've retrieved it and it's not too bad.
I'm looking now.
I can live with it.
Hang on a sec.
I can live with it.
From what was an absolute disaster, is this... This is not still qualified. Colin, what on earth have you done? Dear Lord.
Now what's particularly entertaining about this is the fact that Colin is convinced his hair will grow back. And I've pointed out there's a chance.
I am beginning to worry about this now because I just assumed it would grow back. And people keep saying, well, if
when
it grows back.
It,
Saturday.
Have you noticed much growth so far?
No.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
Jeez.
There's normally always 2 days of growth.
The thing is, I don't know whether people... Because you know what it's like in these days. People are a lot more... They're a lot kinder to each other, aren't they? And nobody's... We're all trying not to be
nasty. I'm not going
to
be kind about
that. Critical. Well, I have to say, people have been generally fairly kind about it. And the only thing that really worries me is this constant, if it grows back... It's a little worrying, but there we are. I'm quite enjoying it. You know, it's what we've got to do in these times, and I know some people don't agree with this, but I do think we've got to take the opportunity to do things and try things that maybe we haven't done before. Maybe we've been...
Cole, I've just got to interrupt you there. The first time we met, you, don't take this the wrong way, you had lovely hair. You had very nice, flowing, lovely...
That can't
slightly,
be taken anything except the wrong way, David. Sorry.
Slightly
David,
Kevin,
you've never said anything so nice to me.
Slightly Kevin Keegan-esque.
can we move on, please, guys?
What were you going to say, David?
I was just going to say, why didn't you go the other way and just let it all grow back? I mean, let it grow out and go Kevin Keegan again.
David, you know as well as I do that 20 years ago... You and I had a lot more hair than we've got just now. A lot more hair.
That's true.
I do keep looking back. You know, there's a picture that Gerard Quinn actually tweeted this morning, myself and Colin McMaster, and both of us were looking a lot more hirsute than we are just now. you forget how lovely your hair looks, but anyway. I've gone for it.
You've been very brave. You've been very brave. And make sure you wear a hat because it's been pretty sunny as well, so you don't want you having a burnt, bald bonce. Let's move on to the topic, though, that we're going to be talking about today, Sebastian Ogier. And I should point out, you're right, Colin, we should be trying different things in this gift that we've been given. Some people, it's horrendous that we're all being locked down and the terrible disease that is rampaging around the world. But the one gift we can take out of this is time. It's something that we never have enough of in life. I know a lot of people are working from home. George and David, you're both still very, very busy. But there are a lot of people that have a lot of time on their hands and can sit down and do those things they've always promised they will do should they ever have time. So we have time to take a look back on the career so far of Sebastian Ogier, 36-year-old French rally driver, currently in the Toyota World Rally Team and a multiple world champion. Discuss.
Yeah, who wants to kick it off? David, do you want to kick it off?
No, carry on, Cole.
No, well, Ogier is someone that I've always had a lot of time for, a lot of respect for, and I know he's a little bit Marmite, and he's developed that throughout his career, hasn't he? And but the one thing that you can never deny about Ogier is his commitment to the sport and the talent he's got, and the talent is just enormous. And I know that, you know, particularly when we were in the middle of this, and it's a perpetual debate, isn't it, about road position. And Ogier was seen to be the one that moaned an awful lot about road position and all the rest. But we mustn't forget that for a number of years, you know, the people that make the rules changed the rules to try and stop one man, and that was Ogier. So he had every right to moan.
I'll just jump in there, Cole, just to say categorically, I remember talking to senior people in the FAA who said, whichever year, I can't remember now, but the year they went from running on the road first on day one to running on the road first and second on day one and two.
Yeah,
if you're a championship leader. They said, we have to stop Ogier winning. It's bad for the sport. It was categorically for that reason.
And do you know what? I think if we look back if we look back through the history, and you can perhaps put me right on this, David and George, but we look back through the history of rallying, and certainly I can't think of an occasion where the rulemakers actually applied a new rule to stop a driver. I mean, yes, there have been rules put in place to if you like, handicap teams who were perhaps looking a little bit dominant. But I can't remember the rulemaker saying, right, we're going to introduce this legislation to stop this one particular driver. So, you know, the fact that I'm kind of getting distracted here because I don't want to talk too much about, you know, the fact that people do see him sometimes, I think, in the wrong light. You know, we want to talk more about his brilliance, but I think it needs to be said because Sebastian Ogier is a thoroughly decent human being. And I think he's one of the most misunderstood drivers, potentially, that we've had over the last couple of decades.
Okay, we'll come back to that as we progress. But let's go back and start at the beginning, shall we? Mm-hmm. He won the JWRC title in the 2008 season. And I think his reward for that was a drive in Wales Rally GB. And he surprised everyone by winning the very first stage.
It was incredible. It was quite incredible. I remember being there at the end of that stage. Don't forget, that was the year where in the south of Wales, we had a lot of snow and a lot of ice. The conditions were treacherous. And, you know, if you were going to make your debut in a World Rally car, those are not the conditions you would have chosen. You absolutely would not have chosen those conditions. But David Ogier reveled in them. It was quite sensational.
It was. Just to correct you slightly on the geography there, Cole, that was the first day we were in Mid Wales, so it was the loop around Haffrin, Meheron and Sweet
Sorry, Lamb. When I say South Wales, I meant we were based in South Wales, but you're quite right. We were in Mid Wales. Yeah.
And it was also that was the year that were some of the stages not cancelled?
Yes, shortened, cancelled.
Yeah. Yeah, they were, simply because of the snow. He probably had the best of the conditions with a few cars going through and breaking the snow and the ice up a little bit. But let's not forget, it was his first time ever competing in a World Rally car. You know, it was extraordinary. And it was a real demonstration, as if we needed one, of what this bloke could do. Because, you know, I mean, all through the junior season, you know, from Mexico onwards, he had totally dominated. Okay, the field of competition wasn't massively strong in those days. But he was absolutely landing. You know, round one of his World Rally Championship career was Mexico, and he finished, what, eighth or ninth or something? And won juniors by a mile. Yeah.
And you know, if we go just step back, that little step back to that junior year, you know, he seemed to come from nowhere. I remember the first couple of rounds, we go, well, how do we pronounce this guy's name? Is it Ogier? I think eventually we worked out Ogier. But I also remember that you know, Spain was later on in that year. I can't remember where Spain was. It was, I think, maybe the last round that year. Where was it? It was Spain. And he had an accident in that event. And I do remember chasing him on the road section to get an interview with him. It was heading back, final stage of the day. They had an accident and they were trying to make the long road section back to service. We came across Julian and Sebastian at the side of the road. And back then, you didn't speak to Sebastian because he didn't speak any English. You know, it was like, no, put his hands in there and said, speak to Julian. We didn't say speak to Julian. He just pointed towards Julian. He just appeared. He appeared from nowhere. Yes, I know he won the Peugeot Challenge and all the rest, but the way that he burst onto the scene like that made you sit up and think, hang on, you know, this kid's got proper talent.
I absolutely, 100%. And, you know, while we stick in that year, in what it was, 08, I think, wasn't it? I remember him coming over for a one-off drive in Ulster. And, you know, you think he achieved a huge amount in Mexico, going to Mexico and winning juniors there. You know, equally, coming to somewhere like Ulster is not easy. You know, it's quite different to the tarmac that you get in,
totally
in,
unique,
in the French Alps,
the
where he's from.
Yeah,
and he won. You know, he was driving a Max car, an R2 Max or something like that, and he won his class, and he was so impressive. Just, you know, and it's these kind of small sort
did
of
did I lose everyone
snapshots. No, George can still hear you, or is it just me that can still
we
hear
can
you?
George, we can hear you, George.
Okay,
you
sorry,
right?
I thought I'd disappeared.
I wanted to bring you in actually there, so I'm going to ask you a question, George. So So Ogier went on, he got his first podium on the Rally of Greece, the Acropolis Rally in 2009, second to Mikko Hirvonen. He's very much part of the Citroën setup by that point. And we'll come to the relationship that he had with Sebastian Loeb a little bit further on here. But how important do you think it was that he had the car that worked for him?
Obviously, it's utterly vital, but again, I mean, as both David and Colin have alluded to, I think if he'd been in any car at all, he would have been up there fighting at the front. And I'm always conscious of the fact that some drivers have scored all their wins in one team and scored really done all their performances in one team over the years. And many of the Italian drivers only ever drove for Lancia, and there was always doubts about whether they were really that brilliant or were they just being given the best car back in the, you know, late 80s and early 90s, even in the 70s. There's infamous events going on. So, but Seb Ogier obviously proved the point in case, you know, when he left the Citroën and went to Volkswagen. And I mean, he did that year in the S2000s. He did an incredible job and gave me one of my most memorable memories on, I think it was Monte Carlo Rally. Was it? No, it wasn't Monte Carlo. I think it was Monte Carlo Rally. Colin, where you heard the distinctive sound of a World Rally car and it was an S2000. I still think that was one of the best moments. That almost bettered some of my faux pas. It's brilliant.
But George, I tell you what else was memorable about that stage. Because we were waiting for Ogier to come through that stage. The World Rally cars were coming through. We were waiting for Ogier. I can't remember. It was the long stage as you came off. So there was what was it called? The stage at the top of the hill, George. Foix. What was it called?
I can't remember the name. Called, I can't even quite remember the geography of where we were, Colin. It's very distressing.
No. Is it? Well, we were in Valence. We were in Valence, and
that was
it. Look at three stages. And
did you,
coming
did,
back.
Hang on a sec, Cole. Did you
was
just say
Saint-Bonnet-le-Froid?
Saint-Bonnet-le-Froid.
I was at Saint-Bonnet-le-Froid.
You were. And then I was down at the, as they came back down the mountain, heading back down towards service, I was at the final stage that day. And that's where the distinctive sound of the World Rally car came from.
Yeah. But it was being
stage,
driven like absolutely.
Well, no, that wasn't him, because he crashed. He got about three splits into that stage and was leading the stage, if I remember correctly, in an S2000, and then had the most monumental crash. The most monumental crash. He was, they were both very lucky to get away with it. Okay. But that was that same stage. It was incredible.
Just to interrupt there, you've alluded to it, but can you explain the unmistakable sound of the rally car?
It was a blooming Subaru, and I remember I couldn't walk into the Subaru service area at the end of the day because they were falling around laughing.
Because you said it was the unmistakable sound of
a world rally car, and it was an S2000 car. I mean, it was an absolute nonsense thing. It was an end of a long day,
but
headphones
Colin,
on, brain fried.
Yeah, and it
nonsense.
Was the most superb sound, Colin. It was an engine being absolutely revved to the limit, echoing off about five cliff sides because Colin's in this gorge. And he's getting the sound coming at him, you know, repeatedly. It was pretty amazing sound. I can remember listening to it as I drove down towards service that night. Yeah. I was listening to it on my phone. I would be dialed into to Bex or to yourself, whoever it would have been, giving me a feedback so I could hear it. And the sound coming through Colin's microphone was just tremendous. But it was, I remember just about having to stop the car for laughing so much when the Subaru had appeared over there. When the S2000 had appeared, it was funny.
Yeah. It was all quite ridiculous. But there we go. But that was Ogier, and that was Ogier's stage. And you know, that was again, what we're jumping forward a little bit. That was the year of the that was the year, as you say, before then the first year with Volkswagen.
Was it 11 or 12?
I think we've got to go back. Hey,
we do.
Cole, we've got to
we
go
do.
Back
we
because
we
you know we've gone far too quickly over the start of his career.
As a
Citroën driver when he was first in the World Rally Car. So he had that incredible debut in
that's the Citroën C4, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And he had that amazing debut in the C4 in GB, and then don't forget Monty in those days. Was it the first year of it being an IRC round, and he came and won it in the S2000 car, didn't he?
He did.
In the 207. But the point for me was early in his career, and this is something we quite often overlook. He was in the junior team, whatever they called it back in those days. But he had a pretty shocking run, a difficult run, until we talked quite quickly about finishing second in Greece. And that was a particularly, horrendously rough year in Greece. And he just drove sensibly. But I think about that time, he was coming under massive pressure. And they were not far off being hoofed out of the team. Who knows if that's entirely accurate. But he'd crashed a couple of times. He'd had some miserable results. And it wasn't working. In testing, we could see the speed. There was pressure on from within the team. There was pressure on him to get rid of Julien, get him out of the car, get someone like Daniel Grataloup in. But Ogier, this is a mark of the man. He stuck to Julien. He absolutely stood by him. And he found, there was that something clicked in Greece, and it was just taking two steps back to take probably 10 steps forward. Yeah. You've seen this 100 times, George, with a driver that's like a bull in a china shop, absolutely giving it everything.
But David, you're forgetting a really vital point here, David, before Greece. A really vital point. Remember who was in charge at the time of Citroën? It was Olivier Canel, a man who was divisive at the best of times. A very, very difficult man, unfortunately, to
he
get
along
with.
He wasn't divisive with Ogier. He was absolutely backing Ogier.
Well, he was. No, he wasn't. Remember, Ogier was given a 5, maybe 6, from memory, rally deal at the start of the year. At the start of the year, he was given 5 or 6 rallies. And he did what every other junior driver progressing from the junior category into the top category, he did what every other driver has done throughout history, and he tried to prove himself in 5 or 6 rounds. What Canel did before Greece was he said, I've made a mistake here. I've made a mistake. At the start of the year, I should have guaranteed him the whole season. So he guaranteed him the season with an understanding there would be one more season on top of that. So all of a sudden, Ogier's absolute desire and need to prove himself on every single rally disappeared.
I don't remember that.
That did happen. I'll guarantee you that happens. It was Canel, and he stood up. And to be fair to Canel, he did actually say, this is my mistake. I should never have given him 5 or 6 rounds at the start of the year. I should have, because the intention was always to give him the whole season anyway. So, I made a mistake in not
treating him mean to keep him keen.
Correct, it backfired.
But that was, that the way that relationship developed with Canel and Ogier was very strong. And then without jumping forward again too far, but when he suddenly got into the factory team, because he replaced Sordo, didn't he? The year after, in what was it, 10 or 11?
2011. But I do want to go back to 2010 in a moment.
Okay, well let's do that then. Let's stay chronological.
Now, the reason I want to go back to 2010 is because it's the first full WRC season. As you mentioned, he also did Monte Carlo in the Peugeot 207 S2000 in that one. Had to retire with an alternator problem on the final day of that particular event. But it was a really interesting season for him. Jordan, I want to know about Jordan because I remember there were team orders where he had to pick up a time penalty and that forced him to drop back in the standings, and I can't remember why.
Oh, George, do you remember, George? It was one of the most infamous mornings, Sunday mornings, in recent rallying history, because, you know, we saw, you talk about tactics that we see nowadays, and David, by the way, some fantastic stuff with you and Adamo. Absolutely loving it.
Yeah, but, fabulous.
Really fantastic stuff. But the one line I took out of there was lots of good stuff, clearly. But when Adamo said, look, I read the rules, and this is George Donaldson-esque. I read the rules, I understand the rules, I apply the rules. Mm-hmm. Now, what we saw that morning in Jordan was similar, but to the absolute extreme. Mm-hmm. It was a day where if you were leading the rally, I think, were you first on the road going into the final day? I think probably, rally leader was first.
I think
what they did from memory is they took Ogier, who was well out of the rally, and they put him first on the road. So they advanced him about 20 minutes, 25 minutes.
Mm. Massive penalty.
And then Ford did something similar with who would it have been, because the battle was between Latvala
and Mikko.
Ford took one of their drivers and they responded and the whole thing got out of hand. And then there was quite a big debrief afterwards, clearly with the FIA saying, hang on, what we're doing here is bringing the sport into disrepute and we can't do this. You know, we understand that the rules allowed you to do it because you chose to sacrifice one of your junior team drivers. But we can't be doing this. It's not right. It's not fair. But it was a heck of a rally. I remember that. In terms of how it helped Ogier, what it meant for Ogier in his career, I'm not really sure. But it was a heck of a rally, that's for sure.
I think we should come back to this in another podcast, because I'm sure that you say it's not fair, but I would love to get George's take on this, because it's part of the game, isn't it, George? And let's perhaps not get into this
it
here.
It is. But I mean, it can sometimes be regarded as a little bit dirty and tricky, but I mean, definitely worthy of another discussion, because there are cases where you can use it very, very cleverly to your advantage, and there's times when you're just leveraging it in that sort of brutalistic and you know, in Adamo's defense, very honest way, making it quite clear the rules say I can do that. In reality, the organizers can, it's in the regulations, at least I need to double check it's still there, but the organizers, the clerk of the course, at his own discretion can reseed the rally whenever they require if they feel that there's something inappropriate happening. So they could actually stop the rally at the start control of a stage. So, you know, if somebody's popped, you know, if Hyundai have popped Danny Sordo in front of one of their drivers to get a cleaner road, the organisers can stop it and they can reorder it at that point. Now, with all the...
That's a very brave clerk of the course that would do that.
Well, it's been done. It was done in Australia, Lisa, where I think it was... I've got a feeling it was Ford had done it. So it was Malcolm, I guess. I could be wrong. I'm not trying to diss anyone at all. But all the teams have done this. And utilise the rules to...
And Gary Connolly was a very brave clerk of the course, wasn't he?
Gary Connolly was a very brave clerk of the course, and he stopped the rally and he reordered it. Mm. And I remember, because I was obviously a team manager at that time and we were talking about it, and I said, no, I said, that can be reordered. The organisers can just redo it. And I know Gary Connolly and he will, and blow me, he did. But he's the only guy that's ever done it. I don't know why it's not been done more often, and it would stop it dead.
I tell you... We will come to that. Yes. We'll have a team orders and playing by the rules episode of the Spin the Rally Pod. And if you've got any questions or any idea about what you'd like us to talk about in that, get in touch at Dirtfish Rally and we'll focus on specific points. So get your questions in at Dirtfish Rally. You can also send them to Voice of Rally or at David Evans Rally. Is that your handle, David? It is. Yes, it is. So let's continue, because as I say, 2010 was a really interesting season. We also had Rally New Zealand. Now, Ogier so close to getting his maiden WC win at Rally New Zealand in 2010.
Wow.
Ooh, that was special. Last stage, wasn't it?
That was last stage, but
Fanger Coast.
But even before that, guys. But even before that, guys, Rally Turkey. He was, if I remember correctly, he was right up there in Rally Turkey, and potentially could have won that one. But yeah, we went to New Zealand, and it was the Fonga Coast. It was the last stage of the rally, and we had how many drivers? Three drivers
Loads.
Could have won it.
And Mikko spun, and then somebody else spun, didn't they?
Solberg. Solberg could have won it, and he crashed into a pole about, I don't know, a few kilometres in. Yeah, there was another problem, and Ogier, because if you're Fonga Coast is a beautiful stage, it's a beautiful flowing stage along the side of that wonderful coastline there. But about the last kilometre, George, it goes under the trees, doesn't it? And it's quite dark and it's quite slippery under the trees, and the surface changes. And I think, oh, hello, telephone call for George Donaldson.
Not me.
And the last maybe not even kilometre, maybe only the last 800 metres, there's a couple of very tight corners. It was damp, it was darker, it was slippery. And Ogier, with four corners to go, winning the rally, spun it and put it down the bank and lost the rally. Four corners to go. It was astonishing. Latvala came through imperiously, having not won a stage all event, and took the win. It was just sensational stuff. It was sensational. But at that
live
point,
TV
we thought,
as well back then,
and that victory margin 2.4 seconds in the round.
Was that the year that Loeb hit that gate thing?
Ah, yes, early on in the rally.
Yeah,
early
he did,
on.
Didn't he?
It was a bridge. It was a bridge parapet he hit. I seem to remember.
That's right. Yeah.
It was the year that we had tarmac stages. Remember that Rally New Zealand, the best gravel stages in the world, and inexplicably, that year they put in a whole load of tarmac stages, and I believe, was it on a tarmac stage?
Were
might
not a
have
mix.
Been.
They were a mix of stages.
Well, it was a mix.
They?
It was a mix. Yeah, it was a mix.
Yeah. It was classic stages that had partly been asphalted, so it was.
That's it. Yeah,
I have to say, I'll just as a brief, and I'm sure we'll come to Sebastian Loeb at some point to talk more about
very soon
about him. Maybe you should save this story then. Yeah, no, carry on.
Well, but I was going to say, let's move on slightly, because, I mean, these 2010 and 2011, such key years for Ogier. And, of course, that first win came at the very next event, the Rally of Portugal, his first WRC victory. And Loeb feeling the onerous task of sweeping on the start of that rally. He was at the front, and it cost him.
For me, you know, I remember that event, and that was, you know, I remember everybody raised an eyebrow there because he was allowed to win. You know, he beat Loeb, didn't he? And there was not a lot in it. And he was allowed to take the win. And maybe that was the start of the time that we started to see that Canel was really kind of starting to back his man. And was that the beginning of the sort of the end of Loeb at Citroën? Of course, it wasn't, because ultimately the big guns like Guy Frekeland came back out and sorted everything out for him, and quite rightly so. Who am I to say it wasn't? But it was such a close event, that Portugal, all the way through. It was a classic, but it was, you know, it was an absolute indication that Ogier could drive quickly and consistently, and he could bring the thing home. You know, he led from early on, didn't he? And you're quite right, Lise. You know, it was the running order thing to start with. And down, you know, any stage in warm sunshine in Portugal, you're going to be crucified first on the road. But those roads down in the Algarve were horribly, horribly loose at times. But yeah, he was superb. You know, a genuine, a proper, you know, not a gifted win at all. It was a good fight, and he deserved it. I think we
need to point out that, you know, this is still relatively early in his career. He's been driving, I mean, what was that in terms of WRC starts? He was probably up to somewhere
20
around
22 or 25 or something like that.
Yeah, but well, I don't even think it's quite as many.
I don't
as
even think it's as many as that now.
If
you count the juniors, yeah, it would be.
If you count the juniors, but if you say WRC starts, I mean, we're talking maybe 16 or 17 WRC starts, and he takes a win, and it could have been earlier. So, you know, you look at the recent crop of WRC drivers.
Guys,
you look
I've
how long
it lost
took
you all.
Tanak to take his first win. Remember that wonderful first win he took in Sardinia. Elvin Evans to take his first win in GB. Mickelson when he took his first win. You know, these were drivers that were many, many seasons into their WRC careers before they managed to convert what we saw as potential talent into real, real deliverable results. And Ogier, following a pattern of what he'd done really through all of his career so far, delivered early on, David.
Let's see. Let's see how long it takes Kelly Rovanperä if when the world gets normal again. But no, yeah.
But I was going to say, what's interesting about this, and we're going to move on to 2011 now, because you've both spoken there about the different political support within the team that both Sebastian Ogier or Sebastian Loeb had in this battle that we started seeing, this little fracture inside the Citroën team. Danny Sordo's results were disappointing, and as a result we saw Ogier get promoted up to the senior team for the end of 2010. So we go into 2011 and he is in the senior team.
What is the most remarkable thing about that, though? The most, George, can you remember what the most remarkable thing was? I'm putting you both on the spot.
David, you go first.
Let me very quickly
just finish what I was going to say. Ogier gets promoted up to the senior team, and he starts 2011 as Sebastian Loeb's equal in the
team. That's it. That is the point. Quite remarkable. You've got a guy who's won, okay, at this point he's won two or three rallies by now. You've got a young junior driver progressing up from the junior team into the main factory team. You've got, I think, a 5 or 6 times world rally champion at that point. Mm. And this was the downfall of Olivier Canel, sadly. He made some decent decisions. This was a very poor one. He appointed them both as joint. There was no number one driver.
Yeah, but Cole, that be? The guy had to make
his mark. And also, just to highlight at this point as well, that we had the DS3 WRC due to start the season, didn't start in Sweden, and so we had a new car coming into the team as well.
Yeah, but at least it's got to be said that here, you know, was that a poor decision? Because at that time, I'm convinced that Guy Frekkeland was still running the team. 100%.
Right.
You know, from behind, from wherever he was, you know, Loeb was managed by Frekkeland. And, you know, he still had such influence over that team. Canel had got this young guy who was clearly super talented in Ogier. And what else was he supposed to do? You know, Ogier was at that point, at the start of 11, he wasn't going to stand for being second best, you know, for another season. He may have done one more year, but that was it. And Canel had to take a gamble. He had to do something to try and shake this, essentially, the shadow of Guy Frekkeland off. And ultimately, it cost him his job. But I just want to say, Mexico, round two that year, that was where things totally crystallised. Do you remember that Ogier was leading? I think, was it going into the last day or the last? I can't remember if it was the last stage. And they were told to hold station. And start of Sunday morning, so the story goes, Sebastian Loeb got out of his car as they were lining up and walked to Ogier's car. Ogier was leading. He opened the door on Sebastian Ogier's car and said, "I slow down for nobody," and shut the door and walked off. Got that got into Ogier's head. And Cole, what happened?
Well, he crashed.
Yeah.
It was the maestro against the apprentice, wasn't it? He absolutely destroyed him.
But let's look.
Ogier did then go on to win Portugal and Jordan.
Just going to say that, Lise. You know, look at how Ogier, you know, that could have floored a lesser driver. That could have kept them down for a long time, that kind of psychological warfare. Ogier immediately demonstrated, you know, back-to-back win in Portugal. And then was that Jordan, was that the super close one?
Two tenths of a second.
Yeah. You know, I mean, what does that say about this guy? You know, going up against someone like Latvala, who'd been around for years. And he won.
How did he, again, the way that they won that, sorry to keep throwing in these funny stories, not funny stories, but maybe slightly off the wall stories, but he won that through intelligence. Mm. If you remember, that flying finish was on a 90 right. The flying finish was actually on a 90 right.
In Jordan.
Right. And in Jordan, if you remember, you know, these weren't really defined roads. So, you know, a normal 90 right, you'd have to take it, wouldn't you? Mm. But in Jordan, all that defined this 90 right was some tape, you know, and that's all it was. So Ogier had worked out with the team beforehand, actually, you know, we don't want to be braking. You know, we want to be flat out through the flying finish. Everyone else was braking through the flying finish to take this 90 right directly at the flying finish. Mm. Whereas Ogier decided, no, I'm going to go straight on. And, you know, there was a little bit of jiggery-pokery went on there because the team had people on that corner to make sure there were no spectators there. So it was the corner, the 90 right, defined by tape, after the flying finish. No one there. Ogier straight through the tape, straight through the tape, full throttle.
Tactics. That is straight through the tape.
And that was the difference in those 0.2 of a second. Mm. That was the difference. And it was just stunning. It was stunning teamwork. It was stunning tactics, as you say, George. And it was dodgy, you know, but they'd covered their bases. They had their people there clearing the spectators away. And let's be frank, there weren't that many in Jordan anyway. so just absolute genius. Just absolute
That's genius. Good dodgy, Colin, though. It's good dodgy. It's inventive. Well, it's creative. It's clever. Smart.
It is all those things. I'd agree with that entirely, George. It was phenomenal.
And if you're not breaking the rules, if you're bending them, you're not breaking them, then you crack on too. So,
can I make my tuppence worth on Ogier and Loeb there? Am I okay to do that, guys?
Well, I was going to say, we'll come on to him, because that's going to be my next question, actually. I just want to mention that Argentina, he rolled, finished without a steering wheel, so that cost him the win in the last stage.
Again, was leading, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. He was leading.
And it was the fight with Loeb again. Yeah. Sorry.
So then we go on to the Acropolis rally, and this is where we really saw the relationship with Loeb deteriorate.
I do remember that it was a
this
dust
is all about
thing,
road
opening.
Yeah. Exactly, who was opening the road, and I think that was the year that we had a lot of dust hanging in the air as well.
And
this isn't the year as well that Petter Solberg spun in the stage and Chris didn't know which way they were going,
That's
whether they were going up the stage or down the stage.
Well, he's not with the nighttime stages, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was the night they started at the Acropolis. They actually started in the centre of Athens, and the ceremonial start, and they came back towards Itea. Is that what it was called? No, was it Itea? Where were we staying? It was near to the Corinth Canal.
Loutraki.
Heading towards Loutraki, and there was a stage that ran into the back end of Loutraki. That ran at night. And remember, Chris and Petter, Chris got lost in his notes. And it was one of the best bits of onboard. You felt desperately for Chris Patterson.
Awful.
But my goodness, how calm Petter Solberg stayed in that situation was and encouraging. You've seen other drivers. Remember Chevy Pons when poor old Carlos Del Barrio.
Yeah, they popped in to get some grapes.
the grapes. And Pons was absolutely livid. Perhaps not the best thing to show young co-drivers, but Solberg's the way Solberg dealt with the issue that his co-driver had on that stage was just quite phenomenal. But you're quite right, David. It was in the evening, and it did define road position, defined the start of that rally.
Dust, darkness and headlights really didn't work well, but I will remind you the Acropolis rally. So this is where on the Saturday night Ogier slowed down. So that Loeb would be opening the road the next day. And he had been getting times. So he based himself on times that were given to him by the team. But there was apparently, quote, a technical problem that stopped Sebastian Loeb getting the reciprocal information.
That's right. I remember because it was the Saturday night and we were in that casino, weren't we? the whole event was based in a casino.
There's a rally on, boys.
And then Loeb came out of service, and I was working, and I'd got back into the casino early, and just as he was going into the hotel, I was walking in the door as well, and he'd really spoken to very few people that night, and I remember vividly him saying, essentially, there are forces within this team working against me.
Yes.
And it was remarkable. And you're right, Lise, that, you know, it had been bubbling, but then suddenly it was out there. And I remember going to see Jerome Bure, who worked for L'Equipe, and telling him that this had just happened. And it was a huge story.
And David, because the accusation, David, was always, or certainly in that part of that season, and remember that there was quite a lot of... You know, there were a lot of tactics being played because road position was so important for the final day. Yeah. You would drive to splits. You would drive to the times that you knew your competitors have set. Mm. And it was remarkable how many times that Ogier's splits stopped working on the final stage. And there was no information from Ogier. We had no idea where he was. And that, I think, is what Loeb was referring to when he said, you know, there's something working against us in this team. But the suggestion at the time was that somehow Ogier's engineers team had found a way of disconnecting the GPS box.
But then we got to Germany, and that
George, didn't you want to mention something about Ogier and Loeb's relationship?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I guess the bottom line was, and I mean, I'm a massive fan of both Sebs. I regard Seb Loeb as an absolute god, and Ogier pretty well the same. They're equal gods to me. There's no supreme one amongst them. They're both brilliant, but Seb Loeb for many years. And he earned his position, make no mistake about this. But he was unequivocally the number one driver at Citroën. And they ran Danny Sordo as the second driver. And Danny quite often got seconds and thirds. Never looked like challenging. And that was it. Following team orders, probably getting paid quite a decent salary as well. Thank you very much. But along comes Ogier, a challenger, another French driver. They lose Danny Sordo and replace him with Ogier. Perfectly good thing to do. Probably also thinking that Seb Loeb is maybe reaching the end of his career because he's done just about everything. The team is unable to compute running two drivers equally, and it was fumbled all the way.
You'd
have to say Citroën, brilliant team all round, nothing but time and respect for them, but my goodness me, they didn't really understand running two drivers, did they? They didn't figure it out at all. Compare it with Tommy Mäkinen, he's running two, three, four drivers now potentially, all with the ability to win a rally, and he's going to deal with it very elegantly by comparison, I suspect.
It was all
and as
around,
you say, David, it all came to a head in Germany.
It did, but was it around this time that Loeb had sort of flirted a bit with Formula One, and he was, you know, there was a lot of question marks around that time, particularly around Germany time. Would he continue? Was he going to retire? Was he going to go elsewhere? But Germany,
Germany, David.
It started
just
with
before the race started. I think they announced he announced he had extended his contract with Citroën.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. At the media function on what would have been the Wednesday night, and that essentially that sealed the fate for both Ogier and for Olivier Canel. I remember the biggest Grand Fromage of all of Citroën came to Germany essentially to make that news with Loeb.
Who had never lost in Germany.
No, exactly. But that must have been the time that Loeb was close-ish to Volkswagen? Was talking to Volkswagen?
Volkswagen was the big threat, wasn't it, to Citroën? And it was the big concern was Volkswagen at that point.
And the big guy from Citroën came in and said, essentially, Citroën without Sebastian Loeb is Paris without the Eiffel Tower. Great quote.
It was astonishing.
And, you know, from that minute onwards, Ogier was finished in that team. Not a hope. He'd got to get out. The way the event played out, there was, some might say, justice in there.
What an amazing battle it was, though, because the two of them were a standout in that rally. Everybody else was somewhere else further down the field. It was all about the Battle of the Serbs, wasn't it?
Completely.
We got to the end of Friday evening, and I think, if my memory serves me correctly, there was something like 6 or 7 seconds in it between the two Serbs. And they'd come to an agreement that whoever leads at the end of the Friday evening, because a 1-2 for Citroën, as you say, at least they'd never lost in Germany. It was more or less, their event, and a 1-2 would be fantastic. An incredible result for them, particularly considering the news that, as you say, David, they just put out earlier in the week. And they decided, or certainly Loeb had decided at this point, this is it, I'm leading, it might be a slender lead, but I'm going to win this event now. And that decision was taken, it was Friday night, wasn't it, David?
Yeah, I'm sure it was. Yeah, absolutely.
It was Friday night. And then they went out to the stages on the Saturday. And if you remember, it was stages to the south of Trier. It was the Panzerplatz stages that we were on. And apparently Ogier that morning had spoken to Loeb had spoken to the Grand Fromage to reiterate, look, I am going to win this. And apparently he'd asked the Grand Fromage, whose name escapes me, I can't remember what his name was, to phone Ogier and just to reiterate to Ogier, we are holding position in this. And Ogier had got the phone call and we understand he'd accepted it, somewhat reluctantly he'd accepted it, but there were some expletives, there was some anger, there was some frustration in the car. Then we get to Panzerplatz, David.
Yeah.
And it all kicked off, didn't it? That was where it kicked off.
The puncture came for Loeb. And I mean, it's fair to say that, they...
Can I just interrupt? Because, Colin, didn't you speak to Ogier early in the day? Because I remember on the road, and I can't remember the quote, but he was... When Ogier gets really tight-lipped, but you know he wants to tell you something, and then he says something that feels like it's almost reactionary rather than, oh, I didn't mean to say that, but I had to say it out loud. Was it something about justice?
That was at the end of the stage. Yeah. So we've got Loeb's come through first, and Loeb, we understand Loeb's got a problem. Remember, it was a 50K stage in those days. It was a monster of a stage.
Yeah. Yeah,
and Loeb had come through, and we could see him losing time. He'd lost, again, from memory, 40-odd seconds. Might have been a little more. Might have been 50 seconds. So the gap between Loeb and Ogier on the stage was down to around about a minute. So Loeb comes through and he jumps out the car and he's out, he's checking the time. And so we've had a minute to speak to him and just literally we're not actually speaking to him because he's looking at that front tyre, he's shaking his head. Mm. We're just about to go in for the interview and Ogier pulls up behind at the stop control. And I don't quite know what he did, but the look on his face was, as I understand it, a slightly mocking look. And for a split second, Sebastian Loeb lost it. And I have never seen anger in Loeb's face, but it was more than anger. It was a look that he wanted to kill Ogier. For a second, for a split second, his face contorted, his eyes were out on stocks. And at the time, I remember saying to the cameraman, who wasn't quite ready, was your camera running? And he said, yeah, it was running. I said, we have to check that because you know what? To be fair to the WRC TV guys, they put that moment into the show and they put it in slow-mo and it was a look of absolute hate. And loathing and disgust and whatever you want to call
we'd
it.
We'd never seen Loeb's character tested like that ever, had we? It just hadn't happened. But then, you know, that was the point, Lise, that you alluded to earlier, that Colt, you then went to Ogier, and what did he say?
went to Ogier, and the first thing he said was, today I have seen there is justice in this sport.
Yes.
And it floored me. It completely, it was one of those, you didn't just say that. You didn't just say that. And that was all he said. That was all he said, George, about the 7-times World Rally Champion. Not just his teammate.
It's wrong.
It was, but that was the end of Kinnell, as I understand it. David, he went pretty soon after that, didn't he?
He went at the end of the year because the end of 11, we were in Bilth Wells in the service, and I remember vividly again standing in a cow shed in Bilth Wells talking to Kinnell about this whole thing, about the way it had all played out. And Kinnell said, you know, I will be gone at the end of this year, and I think they may have announced it, I don't know. And he said, at some point in the next 6 months, a year, whenever, I will tell you the true story. I will tell you everything that happened. And still, Olivier, if you ever happen to catch this podcast, please come to us now and tell us. We never got around to having that conversation, but it was quite clear that it was absolutely just, it was untenable for him to continue.
Toxic. It was toxic, wasn't it?
Totally. And at that time, remember, Ogier started GB and we did the Orm. On the Thursday afternoon, and he went off, didn't he? And he hit the...
Utterly inglorious.
Yeah.
He didn't go off. Yeah, he smacked the car rock face. And broke the suspension.
On the Orm. And again, you know, remember that Sunday morning, the last Sunday morning, I went to find Ogier in that cow shed. And I said, you know, this is your last day at Citroën. How does it feel? You know, this is the team that brought you into this sport. And he was quite lost, you know, and quite emotional. And I can't remember at that time if he'd done his deal to go to VW because there was Malcolm with Ford, or there was Volkswagen. But you know, if he went with Volkswagen, he'd got to take a year out, which is a huge gamble for a guy who at that time had won maybe 7 or 8 rounds at a championship. Or he went with, you know, what was a proven winning car with the Fiesta. And in the end, he took the punt and went with VW. But at that time, I mean, George, you'll remember, we had we knew the VW was strong. We knew that they got a lot of potential because they'd won Dakar and everything. But it was a big gamble, wasn't it?
It was a huge gamble. I mean, there's always the risk that these teams come in and stumble.
We saw
Hyundai come in and stumble. You know, they had a tough start when they come in. It's not a given that they're going to get
George, could you just... Sorry, George, I know it's recording at your end, but we missed what you said, so could you just stop from what you said again then?
Of course it's a massive gamble for Ogier to have gone to VW, because very often these factory teams come in and they're not as smart as they think they are. You know, yeah. I mean, it does occur. That said, the Volkswagen team was very well proven. I knew a number of guys in it, and I was reasonably confident they were going to get it right. But, you know, sometimes these factory teams, they can be a little bit entrenched in their beliefs, and they want to invent everything themselves. So it can go wrong. Yeah, massive gamble, bottom line, massive gamble. But also, can I just add at this point that bad blood between Seb Ogier and Seb Loeb, I don't counter it at either guy. They were both absolute gentlemen who loved the sport massively.
Yeah.
They were put into that position by some circumstances that, well, you can maybe say the team made mistakes. I think it's a little bit unfair to even level it at them. Mm. It was a circumstance that somehow managed to develop that wasn't properly read, based around the fact they had this incredible driver, Sebastian Loeb, who earned his place at the front of the team and probably shouldn't have ever been subject to a driver of equal status. But we know that there were circumstances that led that to believe that they were going to lose him. So, yeah, they needed to get their heir apparent in place. So but it was just a circumstance. But both guys, you know, I would like to think now they could maybe be friends. I'm sure they
are. And they are.
Well, they really are. There's can a huge amount of respect. But at least, can I just make this one more point, George, on that?
Very quickly, you can follow on from that. Just say, 50 minutes, he hasn't won a world title yet.
Right. Maybe this is a two-parter.
I think it might be.
but he, I have to say, though, that, you know, the Ogier in that year won, what, five rounds? Was it five rounds? I think he did win five rounds that year. He could have won the title that year, but he didn't. But George, you know, you're saying you don't apportion blame and that mistakes weren't really made. I'd suggest otherwise. I'd suggest that you know, the fact that they did have that ruptious period that year that unsettled the team, that they weren't able to come up with a solution to keep Ogier in the red colours of Citroën, that was a massive mistake. That was a massive, massive mistake. And at the end of the day, a lot of these things are about communication, how you communicate these things to your drivers, how you sell it to your drivers. And I don't think it's beyond, or it shouldn't have been beyond, the wit of the combined brains and experience and knowledge at Citroën to come up with a solution that kept Ogier in the team and kept Loeb happy with his status as the multiple world champion and the number one driver. I think that was a massive mistake. And I think that defined then Citroën's existence within the World Rally Championship.
Well,
if Citroën had secured...
Colin, I beg to completely differ with you. I know how tough it is to keep those drivers happy. And I can see the circumstance that Citroën were in. Sorry, I really can. And massive mistakes were made, 100%. But I wouldn't be apportioning blame for them. They were circumstances that were very, very difficult to manage.
Yeah, fair play.
And it was...
I'll buy that, George.
It was that whole situation that... That situation that, you know, Frekkeland was still there. And, you know, I absolutely loved Guy Frekkeland. You know, he was just an absolute genius and just the most amazingly charismatic guy to work with and to deal with. But it was impossible for Canel to consider, you know, that he was going to come in and run the team when Guy was still there in the background. You know, I remember the year in 06 when they had the Kronos team. And I remember Mark Van Dalen saying, you know, they had to have a meeting a couple of rounds in because it was impossible for him to make any decisions because Frekkeland was there, you know, all the time, even though it wasn't a factory team. So, you know, I felt a degree of sympathy, a big degree of sympathy for Olivier Canel. And please, Olivier, listen into this podcast and come and let's make another one about exactly
David,
what happened.
David, he's not talking to English journalists.
Who?
Canel, wasn't that what he said?
Pourquoi?
what was his quote? What was another one of the great quotes that year?
Oh, I can't remember. I always got on really well with him.
Exactly. No, but I think it may have been to our colleague Richard Rogers when he said, "I am not talking to English journalists because all English journalists tell lies."
Ooh.
Remember that?
No,
do you not remember that?
Heard. Good Lord, I don't remember that one.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
But
so,
no,
anyway, that's maybe why he's not been on the phone to you, David.
Yes, absolutely. He went to Oak. Was
well,
it Oak Racing?
I liked Olivier Canel, but yeah, I have to say that Mr. Frecklin and I weren't the best of pals.
We know.
Yeah.
known as Grizzly. Was he known as Grizzly?
I've had serious issues there, shall we say.
he was a fairly fearsome kind of character. But no, when Citroën came in, whenever it was, 01, 02, that setup with Freckelin and Jean-Claude Vaucard designing the car, I just loved that. It was manna from heaven for me to go and talk to them.
Jean-Claude Vaucard is a god. There's a genius. Podcast on its own. I will tell you all about that guy. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah,
no, George, question I've got for you, which I've had for a while, bearing in mind that we will have to come back to complete the career of Sébastien Ogier. Is the term team boss a misleading term? Are you actually in charge of much?
Gosh, that is the subject of a whole podcast as well, the dynamics of that in the different teams. So, yeah, quite an interesting topic to try and explain all the architecture. So, It varies from team to team massively. Basically, the team principal is the boss. End of story. Make no mistake, in M Sport, Malcolm Wilson is the boss. Mm. At Toyota Team Europe, when I was there, Uwe Andersson was the boss. I was allowed to do whatever I wanted, as long as it was what Uwe wanted, which was never spoken about. But bear in mind, I grew up in that team. That's how I entered that team as my entry into the WRC, the professional world of motorsport. So I only knew the TTE way, so it was pretty straightforward. But about once a month, maybe once every 2 months, Uwe would fall out with me inexplicably for no good reason that I could figure out. And being a little bit headstrong, I would let him stew a little bit for a day or two. And eventually I would wander through to his office, if it was off an event, with an espresso from the espresso machine in my office. I would wander through and say, sit down and say, Uwe, I said, I seem to have upset you again, Uwe. You have to tell me what it is I've done. You shouldn't have to ask me. You should know what you've done wrong. Uwe, I do 70 or 80 things a day. You know, honestly, the only thing I do is for the team. And the debate would go on a while, but basically... I ran the team operationally, but I didn't run the team technically. That was run between Uwe and the engineers. Operationally, it was run between me and Uwe. The driver strategy was basically Uwe, engineers, and me a little bit. So it went between three of us, really. Obviously, the drivers and the gravel crews, etc., etc. So I don't think we were overly strong, tactically speaking, but I think our general strategy was pretty good. Or maybe it was the other way around, actually. Maybe our tactics were pretty good, but our strategy was open, shall we say, because we ran two equal drivers in the years I was there as a team manager. So I was in a slightly unusual time, 2005. Sorry, 1995 was the year that we had the ST205, and that wasn't a great year. It wasn't a great car, but we had two equal drivers, Juha Kankkonen and Didi Auriol. We also had Armin Schwartz, but he was one rung back in terms of performance. But an interesting driver, all the same. But not quite got that edge that the top two had.
We need to jump. Another
subject, but yeah, totally. It varies from team to team.
But there's so much to talk about there, George, isn't
absolutely
there?
You know, huge interesting stuff, I guess.
Massively interesting. But I just I was about to ask you a question. And thought, no, I can't, because we'll be gone for another 10 minutes.
I can't answer.
No,
you can.
You can, but it would be a 10-minute answer, and I'd want 20 minutes of answer. So I think we perhaps, at least, do we spike that one and come back to it?
I think we'll come back to it. We'll do Team Boss. That's on my list of podcasts to do.
Yeah.
Team Boss.
Sounds
are they,
good. Thank you for
are
the
Are they
question,
worth
Lisa.
The title?
Yeah. Oops. Well, in my case, obviously. Yeah, but...
Well, I think we've kind of run out of time for this edition of Spin the Rally Pod, talking about the rise of Sébastien Ogier. We were hoping to cover his entire career, but just too many good stories to talk about. So we'll have to come back. And we haven't even got close to him winning his first WRC title. Maybe we'll start with that next time round. If you want to get in touch, it's at Dirtfish Rally. Send us your questions, any topics you'd like us to talk about, any questions you want, any of the experts. That's David Evans, Senior... Head senior writer, is that your title? Senior head title?
I think it's now chief bottle washer, something like that. Lee.
Chief bottle washer at Dirtfish Rally. Yeah. Colin at Voice of Rally. So many good stories to be told. If you want Colin to dig into his extensive and very good memory at Voice of Rally, but at Dirtfish Rally, send it to there. And of course, George knows everything there is to know about running a rally team. I'm just a rally fan who sits back and listens to these stories and keeps herding the cats, which is why this 45-minute podcast is now an hour long. But we will be back with the next edition of Spin the Rally Pod, where we'll continue looking at the career of Sebastien Ogier. See you later, lads.
See you, Lise.
See you, Lise.
Thanks, guys.